We're in for a treat. I say we are in for a treat tonight. Our speaker... I didn't know Charlie. I do know Charlie now. And he hails from one of the states that I had some trouble in. Well, he graduated from that state. I don't know where he graduated or not. I'll let him tell you about that. But I'm not going to take up any more of Charlie's time. I'm going to give you Charlie L. from Washington, D.C.
Howdy. My name is Charles Lindenwood. I'm an alcoholic. I'm delighted to be here this evening. In fact, I'm delighted to be anywhere. A lady asked me a while ago, said, Charlie, are you nervous on a time like this before you come talk at a meeting? And I said, no. Why? She said, well, what are you doing in the ladies' room? I said, what does it look like I'm doing? Man, before engaging in any great or important undertaking, should always invoke the blessing of deity. This is an important occasion, not only to you, but to me. Therefore, I'm going to ask you for just a minute to pray for me, that I may give a talk that will be acceptable to you and me and God Almighty. If you ain't through praying, you keep on, because I'm going to need all I can get. Now, you got a job to do tonight here, and I got a job to do tonight here. Your job is to listen, and my job is to talk. And if you get through before I do, why, just quietly go on home. I'm what they call a low-bottom drunk, and I realize it, and I never was too bright. In fact, long as I've been sober, I still sit on the side of the bed with one sock on, wondering if I'm getting up or going to bed. I was a kind of a drunk that, well, I was like this. I had an old drinking buddy. You know, drunks always got a drinking buddy. And we used to drink to the point where we'd have to get off the street. And we'd get us adjoining rooms in a hotel. And he'd get in the one and I'd get in the other. And we'd have the door open between us. And we'd be at the grunting stage. And he'd say, hey. I'd say, who? And he'd say, come here. And I'd say, oh, I can't. And he'd say, why? I'd say, man, I can't hardly stay where I am. I felt like I was hard luck. I always seemed to me like it nice things happened there. I was kind of like old hard luck Clyde from down home. Old Clyde had him a 40-acre farm. It wouldn't grow nothing. And he had about 8 or 10 wormy kids. And little old puny wife, just sickly as she could be, and a mule that was all bones and had an old busted down plow. And one morning he went out and hooked this old beat up mule to this old broke down plow and went up the furrow about 20 feet, and the plow caught on a root and jerked this poor old mule, and he dropped dead. Broke the plow, and old Hard Luck Clyde just dropped them reins and said, "Why? Why?" And the sky all turned dark. And then this shaft of light shone right on old Clyde, and this voice boomed out and said, "Clyde, somehow or other it just seemed like you kind of tee me off." Did you ever feel that way? Down home, when I say down home, I know by now you're wondering where the hell did he get that accent. I come from Arkansas, from North Little Rock, and there's a lot of smart folks come from there. And the smarter they are, the quicker they come. No, I didn't mean that, because I love Arkansas, and I still got a home there, and I go back every chance I get. And I'm figuring on going back there in a couple of days. I love it down here. The only reason I'm up north is because I make a living up there. See, I didn't leave Arkansas because I wanted to. They suggested I go. In fact, I was a kind of a cantankerous drunk. Actually, I was argumentative, and I remember on one occasion I was arguing with a guy, and I asked him, I said, "Did you tell so-and-so I was a SOB?" And he said, "No, I don't know how he found out." We had this old fellow down home that was good-natured, and everybody loved him, and he just wasn't too bright. And he went over to the the blacksmith shop one day, and they was making some horseshoes, and he watched them for a while. And finally he asked this fellow, says, "What's them?" And the fellow winked at this other guy and says, "Well, they're horseshoes." He said, "I didn't know horse in horseshoes." And the fella winked at this other guy, figured he's going to have some fun out of him. And he says, "Yeah, they wear horseshoes." He says, "You want to see one?" He picked up one of his horseshoes, hot, you know, and handed it to him. And he dropped it, man. He says, "Was it hot?" And this old boy, "No, it just don't take me long to look in a horseshoe." I had an Uncle Ben that lived down Curtis, Arkansas. Dr. B, you know where Curtis is? He lived down there, and it's kind of sparsely settled down there. And they had a cyclone. Just blew thunder out of everything. And Grandpa and Grandma all lived back in there. And this cyclone had tore up things so bad, they sent a welfare individual back in there. Nice woman. Had this pad going around checking up on the damage to see how much was needed. And as she checked on things while she's going around clucking, and she was standing there by the porch, and we had an old rooster back in there that the wind had blowed all his feathers off of. But Grandma's so tender-hearted, she had made him a pair of overalls. And when this old rooster come pecking out from under that porch, this welfare woman looked at him and said, "I got it, I've seen everything." And old Grandpa kind of roused up and says, "No, you ain't, lady." Says, "You just wait till a hen struts by here." And he takes out after her on one leg, trying to get them galluses down with the other. By golly, then you've seen everything. Uncle Ben was a good old boy. Uncle Ben was my drinking uncle. And it wasn't these fellas that picked up things, brought them home. One time he brought a rope home, dragging it home, and after he got there, he couldn't figure out whether he'd lost his mule or found a rope. But they had a policeman there in this little old town, and he's dragging his chain home one day, just walking down the road there, pulling his chain, and dragging this old policeman drove his car up there and stops his up. What are you pulling that chain for? Uncle Ben says, did you ever try to push one? He's pretty smart. I loved Uncle Ben. He staggered a lot when he got drunk, and he fell in the pig pen one night on the way home. And it's so comfortable, he just laid there. Upside of Old Sow. Great fine Old Sow, and he got to rubbing up and down on her stomach. Just rubbing, and pretty soon he whispered in her ear. Just rubbing her stomach, you know. He said, Martha, how come you saw all them buttons on your nightgown? They let me travel quite a lot, and I enjoy it. I love to meet new people, and they sent me up in Pennsylvania not long ago, and I got in amongst a bunch of friends, Quakers. They're these folks that say thee and thou, and I always try to get out and get amongst the folks, and I was out leaning on this fence watching this old Quaker plow with one of these old blue-nosed Arkansas mules. And this old mule wouldn't gee, and he wouldn't haul, and at the end of the turn row, he'd take a great wide swath. He was stepping all over the corn, and finally, in complete exasperation, this old Quaker said to this mule, mule, thou knowest I cannot curse thee, and thou knowest I cannot beat thee. But what thou dost not knowest is that I can sell thou to a Baptist. And he will beat the hell out of thou. I like to look at AA and life, and the two are synonymous, as if it were a ladder of life. Now, your ladder of life and my ladder of life and her ladder of life and his ladder of life, we've all got ladder of lives, but some of your ladders are longer than others. If you are some sort of an official in some big outfit like General Motors, you got a ladder that reaches way up into the ethereal. And if you're just ordinary working man, like a bricklayer, salesman, taxpayers, you know, well, you still got a right long ladder, and it reaches right up far, and you can still run up and down on them rungs a long time before society is going to point you out as a person that isn't taking care of your obligations. In other words, you're still paying your dues at the lodge, and you're still keeping up with the children's clothes and paying the rent and the mortgage and all this sort of thing. And then there's them low-bottom drunks like me. They got real short ladders, and they don't have to step but one rung or two to lay right on the bottom. And I had one of them little old short ladders, and it was sitting in a hole. And as a result, the first time I ever took a drink in my life, I got drunk and passed out in the backyard where we raised chickens. I don't know if you ever passed out in a chicken lot or not, but you're a mess. And we raised them old messy kind. Rhode Island Red and Dominickers. My mother came out in the backyard and found me passed out in my new hat. And she never had seen me looking like that before. In fact, she never had seen anybody looking like that. And she took me in the house and gave me the only therapy she knew. A hot bath and a dose of castor oil and an enema. I was the cleanest drunk in Arkansas, inside and out. And if I'd had any sense at all, I would have stopped drinking right then, because I got some kind of sick. But this was just the beginning. I thought I had found utopia. And I remember this started a series of events which I will try to unfold. And you ever notice how a speaker, when he takes his watch off, you know what that means? He's long-winded. That's all it means. Everything else in AA means something. That means something. I'm going to put it back, because I'm going to talk till I get through anyhow. I didn't come down here just to visit. I come down here to talk. And I remember this was during the days when we made homebrew. And the way we did it, I had a lovely little wife, and she liked to drink homebrew too. And we'd take a batch of homebrew and we'd put it in a number 3 wash tub and set it in the middle of the room and crack ice all around, get good and cold. Then we'd call up and say, "Come on over, a bunch of us gonna get drunk over here." We would. Lord have mercy. And the next morning, there'd be 2 or 3 left. Not beer, folks. I mean folks you didn't even know. I remember one morning I was going to the bathroom, and there's a gentleman sitting there. I waited a while. Finally, I said, "You through?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "You mind moving over?" Well, he got up, and I don't know how long he'd been sitting there, but he was all red wrong. Circulation had been cut off, and he kind of gimped when he got up. But he was nice. He was polite. And then there was another time I opened up the closet door, and here stood one. Just stand there. I said, "Howdy." And he's nice, too. He said, "Howdy." And I said, "What are you doing there?" He said, "Well, you've got to be somewhere." That sort of drinking, we continued this. And then we did a thing that we called having a weenie roast. What we'd do, we'd rent a U-Driver. This would cost about $5, and we'd buy a bale of hay, cost 35 cents, and scatter that all over the truck, and we'd get a gallon of White Lightning for $2. And we'd have a few drinks of White Lightning and put this wash tub full of home brew up in the back of the truck and let the drunkest one drive. And we'd drive out to the lake, and we'd get a gang of hot dogs. You'd get about 50 cents worth, you'd get a great bunch like that. And we'd go out and cremate these weenies and drink this White Lightning and this homebrew and dance and sing, just have a ball, build a big campfire. And next week, the conversation over the phone goes something like, "Did they get that truck out of the lake yet? And have they found old Joe and his rose out of jail?" I mean, this was just ordinary, everyday social events. And then I'm down another rung on my ladder of life, and then one morning the boss called me in and told me that as of now I was to be separated from the role, that they had put up with me about as long as they could. And I said, well, Mr. Mitchell, what made you arrive at this? He said, the janitor just come in and complained about you puking in the trash. And I was fired, and I remember I walked out of his office, and as I went out, I said, he'll call. They can't run that place without me. And I went home and waited for him to call, and while I was waiting, I spent what money we had in the bank, the whole $12. And I was patient. I waited for him to call 12 years. And I started negotiations. That's when you take the toaster out under your coat to the bootleggers and the waffle iron, little negotiations. And then I started higher negotiations. That's when you call up and say, what are you giving for 9x12 rugs today and sofas? And it was long about this time that my wife left. Took the dog with her. Oh, I missed that dog. And I continued negotiations until I was sitting there in an empty house. Nothing but me and a soggy mattress. I want you to think that over a little while. And bottles. Everywhere you look, there was bottles. There was empties in everything in the house. Any drawer you pull open is empty. And actually, if you're sitting there wondering if you're an alcoholic or not, this is the criteria. You can get them bottles in, but you can't get them out. That's it. That's it. And I remember there was a park near where we lived, and I used to go out way in the wee hours of the night. Wouldn't be nobody up but me and the police. But still, I'd look both ways before I'd open the door and go out with this great bag empty. And I'd go way out in the park. And I wouldn't just set them down and walk away. I'd take one out and flip it. And then sow them like seeds, you know. I never did know why I did that till a psychiatrist finally told me, said, you got a trauma. I said, clarify that. He said, you're protecting garbage men. I said, protecting garbage men? He said, yeah. Say, everybody in town knows that you're drunk but the garbage man. And it was true. I never would set it empty in my trash. My trash was pure. I'd put them in the neighbor's trash. And it's a fact. The garbage man never knew I drank. And I never saw him. Don't know why I was protecting it. But, well, that's neither here nor there. Then finally I come to another rung in my ladder, and that's when I sold the house, drank it up. And then I drank up the last thing I possessed. My old beat-up automobile. It had run into everything in Arkansas. It had bumps on top. And I'd been sober the longest time before I found out how them knots got on top of that car. I'd been running under trees out in the woods, trying to find some place to do some quiet drinking. And after I sold... Actually, I didn't sell it. There was a fellow that sold home brew, and he told me that he'd take the car off my hands and I could drink it up. And one day I was drinking on a home brew over at his place, and he said, guess what? I said, what? He said, you just drunk up your car. Well, there I was. I didn't have no place to sleep. I'd been sleeping in that old car, and so I moved back home with Mother. She was delighted. Her drunken son had come home. And I started negotiations with her stuff. Me and another drunk was loading a washing machine on the truck one day when she come home from work. And she let out a war whoop that I never have heard before or since, and he flat disappeared. I don't know where he went, and I wish I could. But I know I didn't negotiate with any more mother stuff. Then come the time I got arrested. I guess every drunk remembers his first arrest. Because North Little Rock is a small enough town where everybody knows everybody else in their business. And I was no exception. And these police, when I got a little bit too much to drink, why, they'd come up and they'd say, "Charlie, why in the world don't you straighten up and fly right?" Or ask you something like, "Won't you turn over a new leaf?" And you knew very well the only one that was ever successful at turning over leaves was Adam. And then they would tell you, "Now, you go on home and behave yourself and get off of my beat. Act right. Your mother and your folks wouldn't appreciate this." And I'd go on home. Then one day, there's this policeman that didn't know I come from a good family. And he got me by the belt at the call box. And you know, they tippy-toe you when you're like that, you know? Yep, like that. That keeps you off balance. But I knew he was a good man, and he was going to let me go after he gave me a little talk. And I kept tippy-toe agreeing, you know, agreeing with him. And he kept on, and the wagon come, and they put me in. They took me clear to jail, put my name on the book, opened the door, and shut it and with me inside. And I said, "Damn, Faye, haven't got me locked up." And then I started hollering and calling him names. I referred to his ancestry in no uncertain terms. Oh, loud. But you know how you are when you get arrested. You're loud at first, but as you get sober, you get quieter. Until finally you come up with something like, "Officer?" "What am I charged with? Can I have some water, please, sir?" And you see that you're not going to get any attention, and you start thinking, "My God, what am I going to tell that judge in the morning? I got to get out of here. I got responsibilities. I got to go to work. I haven't been to work in 3 years. And you sit there and you think, "Now, if the judge says this, I'll say this. And if he don't say that and he says this, I'll say this. And if he don't say that and says this, I'll say this. If he don't say..." This is your alternate plan. And all night you rehearse what you're going to say to the judge the next morning. Finally comes next morning and they call your name. And they say, "Charles Lindenwood." And you go out and you stand in front of the judge and your legs are shaking like that and both eyes are trying to get in the same socket. The judge says, "You charged with being drunk. How are you pleading?" You say, "Guilty," and run on out. And you have to ask one of them other Peckerwoods, "How much did he give me?" In my case, it turned out to be $10 or 10 days. And I called up the man that we bought groceries from on credit, and he came down and put up to $10. And from then on, it was paying out. Because once you get arrested, you seem like you arrest prone. Here's a man going like that. Damn right, he's dead. But it's true. Once they arrest you and see that they can lock you up and then there's no repercussion, well, then you're their quota for the month. I kept getting locked up and paid out and bought out, and then it got to where I did the time. And this is an experience, because you always wonder, what do they mean about that $10 or 10 days? And then you find out. And I got to doing this so much. Actually, I was doing life on the installment plan. Well, they let me help the truck drivers to do my time because I was a local man. They knew that I wasn't going to run, and they let me help the truck drivers to do the time. And finally, one day, they put me on with the dog catcher. And I was right in my glory because I love dogs. And dogs, they know when you like them. And me and this dog catcher went out, and all I had to do was go... Man, I had me a little old dog in my arms, and he wagging his tail and licking me, and I'm doing like that, you know, set him in the truck, you know. I said, we going for a ride. Pretty soon, I get a whole truckload of dogs, and we drive on out to the pound and back up to this steel cage and put all them dogs in there, and this man come over with this bucket of paint, and he said, Charlie, I want you to take this bucket of paint now and daub some of it up high on their shoulders where they can't lick it off. I said, for what? He said, well, don't you notice all these dogs got different colors on them? This means when we picked them up. And if we keep them for over 2 weeks, we shoot them. I said, you mean that I've been out here all day with you picking up these nice little old dogs, somebody's pets, and you brought them out here now and you're going to put some paint up there on them so that they can't lick it off. And then if nobody knows they're here in 2 weeks, you going to shoot him? He looked at me and he said, what the hell do you think? We just collecting dogs? He had to go to the other part of the pound for something. He ought not to have done it. Because while he was gone, I let all the dogs out. The red ones and the yellow ones and the black ones and the blue ones. And when he got back, there was just me and one little old dog left wouldn't go. And I was trying to say, whoop, 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 whoop. He said, what have you done? I said, I have turned your dogs loose. That's what I have done. Now, you know, when they bring a speaker from out of town, there's usually a turning point in his story where he gets from where he was drinking and things was bad to the time where he really accomplishes something. And this is a sort of a mark for him. In my case, that's it. That's the nicest thing I ever did in my life. Well, they got mad at me because I had done this. I turned all them dogs loose, and the next time I got arrested, they sent me out on the county farm. And I wasn't used to farming. When I got out there, it was in the spring of the year, and they unloaded me and a bunch of more drunks, and they took us out on the turn roll. First, they took us to the tool shed, gave us all hose. And this old captain, he talks so sweet. He come out and he says, now, fellas, he says, that corn out there, says, that's mine. And that Johnson grass that's in it, that's yours. And I want you to get your grass out of my corn. Well, there was just one thing wrong with this. In the spring of the year, when corn is just up about 2 or 3 inches, and the Johnson grass is growing in amongst it, they both look just exactly alike. And all the rest of them peckerwoods went to hoeing, and the captain said, now leave three to a hill. And I was leaving three or something. I was going along there. Everybody else going along chopping. I was chopping. And here come the captain up behind me on this great, big, beautiful black horse he rode. And he come up and he said, son, this is sweet. He said, son, you don't know much about farming, do you? And I said, no, sir, I don't. I figure he's going to put me in the office where I belong. He said, I'm going to show you the difference between corn and Johnson grass. I thought, ain't he a nice man? He said, get down. I said, get down. He said, yes, just lay down there on your stomach. And I began to suspicion something. He went over to his horse and he got this leather about 3 feet long with a wooden handle on it about like that. and he unfurled that on my posterior.
What?
And hollered, Lord, you could have heard me clean to town. He hit me 3 times. And you know, when I got up from there, I could tell corn from Johnson grass as far as I could see it. And he taught me near about all there was to know about farming with that same little educational implement. He taught me how to keep potatoes from freezing in the wintertime. Taught me how to take care of the cattle and milk them. He taught me how to dig ditches and grade roads and put on roofs and mend fences. And he taught me how to plow. This is a chore. And I never will forget, this was in the spring of the year, too. And there's a fella come in and shook me, and he said, hey, Charlie, get up, boy. He said, you on the plow squad. I said, I don't know anything about plows. He said, we'll teach you. And I could see that leather come. Well, they took me out in the lot, and they assigned 2 real frisky mules to me. Old Bruce and Eagle. And I couldn't catch them. They hold their heads away. I couldn't no more get a bridle on a mule than I could fly. And 2 of the other Peckerwoods helped me get bridles on old Bruce and Eagle. And we went out to turn row and hooked them babies up to that plow. And here we go out across that field and left a furrow look like a nervous snake. Here come the captain on that beautiful black horse. He walked up behind me and he said, son, this is sweet. He always talked sweet like that, and he always called me son. I called him son, too. Very quietly. He said, son, it looks like I'm going to have to teach you to plow, don't it? And I said, do you? Well, he said, get down. I get down, and he gave me 3. And I got up, and there stood Bruce and Eagle. Had a sort of a nonchalant look on their face, and Bruce had a smirk. Just like I told you so. Well, the captain rode on off, and I went down the turn row and picked up a limb about the equivalent of a 2x4 and come back and whack, wham! I hit both them mules upside the head. I said, boys, we got to have understanding. Now, the captain said that he got to have a straight furrow, else somebody going to get their ass tore up. And it ain't going to be mine. Well, that seemed to get through to them mules, and the captain had done got through to me. And I mean, I got a tight rein on them mules. We went across that field, I mean, left a furrow. It's just as straight as you could find anywhere in Arkansas. And me and them old mules became inseparable. They assigned them mules to me because I kept coming back. You know, in AA they say, come back. Well, before I got to AA, they said, come back. Down then I did. Well, I never have quite been able to figure out why it is that you and me have got to butt our heads up against a brick wall. And we've got to learn the hard way everything we learn. I've never been able to understand this, but it was true in my instance, it was true in yours. And I remember that on the day before I would leave, sometimes I'd get awful nervous because I wouldn't know what I was going to do. At least on the county farm, I had security. I had Bruce and Eagle. I had a job where I was wanted. Needed and loved. And I'd say to the captain, well, Captain, tomorrow's my day to go. He'd say, I know it. I know it. We gonna miss you for a day or two. And I said, no, sir, Captain, I ain't gonna come back this time. He'd say, well, in case you do, Bruce and Eagle will be here. And I'll keep your job open, and I won't let anybody sleep in your cot. And he would, and they was, and I did. Sometimes I wouldn't get clear of town before the police had had me, because here's what had happened. I'd be just as sincere as anything in the world. I'd run in one of my old drinking buddies. Howdy, Charlie. When did you get out? I was always just getting out if I was out. And I said, just got out. And he said, well, let's go celebrate. No, sir. No, sir. I want to get me a job and straighten up and fly right. And I meant it. I said, now, all I need is a room for a little while and just some clean clothes. I'll go on out to Mother's. He said, well, that's fine. I'm glad to hear you're going to do that. Let's go get a beer. All right. We'd go in and sit down, and the man would say, draw two. And I'd sit there and suck on them suds and grow about 7 feet tall, and the waitress would come by, and I'd be friendly. And first thing you know, I'm back out at the call box. Because I know he was a nice policeman. And I'd go back out to the county farm. And I'd get my same two mules back, old Bruce and Eagle. And a lot of times when I was doing time, I'd wonder, like you've wondered when your heart was breaking, why it was that I couldn't be like other people. Why couldn't I work again and be with my wife? And why couldn't my mother be proud of me? And why couldn't I wear nice clothes like other fellas? I was sober and I was working for the state. How come I couldn't work for somebody else for pay? I did a good job for the captain and the leather. For some reason or another, it'd be the same thing over and over and over and over. Finally, I decided, well, I'll just commit suicide. So I got me a half a pint and went into the bathroom. We had little gas stoves at home in Arkansas. And I took paper and shoved it in all the cracks so no gas would leak out. And I cracked my half a pint and put both lids down on the throne. I didn't want to drown. And I took a sip out of my half pint and listened to that gas go. And I'm thinking about the funeral. And how nice I'd look. And how people would come and lean over the casket and look in, and they'd say, oh, don't he look nice since he's quit drinking. Then I got to thinking about who all would be there. Couldn't think of a damn soul. But all my buddies were down under the bridge drunk or out at the county farm doing time. And the only ones I could think of was me and Mother and the undertaker and whoever pallbearers they hired. And me and Mother was the only ones I even knew out of the whole bunch. And anyway, I was getting a headache. And I was running out of whiskey. And that damn thing looked like it'd be too permanent anyhow. So I drank the rest of my whiskey and turned off the gas and opened up the window and pulled all this paper out of the cracks and flushed it down and commode and went out in the other part of the house and said, don't anybody in this house ever have to go to the toilet. Why, a man laying there and dying, nobody ever knows. actually wanted was somebody to come in the toilet there and see me sitting on the throne with the gas running and my little eyes with tears in them. And say, oh, my God, he's committing suicide. Then start being nice to me, see? But it didn't work that way. In fact, there never was a period that long before or since that there wasn't somebody in that bathroom. There was a fellow one time went up to New York, and he got in that New Yorker hotel and had a room on the 30th floor and drank himself into oblivion, and finally he was crawling around. You know when you crawl around, like, who was it said to chin himself on the commode? He's crawling around, and he couldn't find his bottle. Finally, he just jumped out the window. And along about the 15th floor, he remembered where he'd hid it and hollered, "Help!" Well, too late then. Don't do that. Don't do that. I mean, give yourself a chance to change your mind. Drunks are always getting into trouble. I don't care where they are. We had this old drunk hung around town. Everybody loved him, but he slobbered a lot. And which ain't a bad vice if folks know it, you know, and steer clear. But he got on this bus one day, and it was a new driver, and while he was trying to put his money in the cash box, he was slobbering on this bus driver, and he didn't know him. And he let that clutch out and rammed on that gas and threw this poor old drunk clean to the back end of the bus, where he sat down in the lap of a dunkard pastor. He looked at this dunkard pastor. Notice how quiet, how softly I said that. He with all this beard and flat, he said, "What are you?" This pastor said, "I'll have you know I am a drunkard pastor." This drunk said, "I believe that's what that bus driver just called me." This doctor down home had treated this fella for 2 years for yellow jaundice before he found out he was a Chinaman. But he was a nice fella, and he was teaching this young doctor all he knew. In fact, he sort of sponsored him through his medical college and his training, his internship, and the night before he was to hang out his shingle, this young doctor, this old doctor, said, "Now, son," says, "I'm proud of you. You've done a wonderful job." But he says, "Now, there's one thing I want to admonish you about." He says, "You're going to make mistakes. You'll make a lot of them. You'll bury some of them. But," he said, "don't ever admit one." Well, this made an impression on this young doctor. And his first patient come in the next day, and he was all bent over, and he said, "Doctor, I want you to look me over and tell me what's wrong with me." And the doctor said, "Get up on that table." You ever notice one of them tables got wheels on, bend everywhere? A well man can't get up on one. Anyway, this poor fellow finally got up on the table, and this young doctor examined him very carefully, and he came up with his diagnosis. He said, "You have got locked bowels." Well, this fellow liked to hit the ceiling. He said, "Locked bowels, for the Lord's sake. I come in here because I got to run." This young doctor says, "Yes." Says, "Your bowels are locked in open position." Well, it was along about this time that they decided I was a nut. And the family all got together and they decided that something had to be done. And they called me in I mean, it was at this stage of the game where it's serious. I was at the stage where they'd let me come in, but I couldn't carry a key to the front door. And they had me back in the back part of the house, you know, and I wore long-handled underwear winter and summer. In the summer, I dropped the gate for ventilation. And sure as we'd have company, somebody would open the door and say, "Now, don't come out. We've got company." You know, and slam the door. Hell, I'd come out, laughing all. Say a few bright things to entertain them, make them feel welcome, you know, and wander on back. And something had to be done. I mean, they brought these good men of the cloth. I expect you've called on many of them. Didn't know what the hell to say, but you called on them. But it's the truth. I mean, you ask him, hell, what does he know about drinking? I mean, you ask him, did you ever chin yourself on a commode? No. Hell, he never done that. But anyway, my mother was always getting these wonderful men of the cloth to come, and I'd hear these voices out in the other part of the room. House, and they'd be going, I think, who the hell has she got out there now? And then this head would come in, just the head. But first, she'd say, "Well, I'd love for you to talk to it. It's in there." That's when you become an it. And then this head would just come in, weird looking, teeth all over the place, smiling and say, "You're Charles, aren't you?" I'd think, what a masterful deduction. Here this guy's been talking to my mother for 15 minutes, he decides it's me. And he said, "May I come in?" And he's in. And he's sitting down. And he's looking and he's thinking, what can I say to this poor red-faced stinking thing? And I was thinking, too. I was thinking, wonder has he got a drink? And then they always give you John. There's two Johns, you know. Well, he had John the Baptist, John the Evangelist, and I had John Barleycorn. He had me outnumbered, and he'd leave and he'd say, "Now, Charles, I want you to come see me." He's hoping to God I wouldn't. I know, 'cause I went. And when you get down to the church, before you can get into the sanctum sanctorum, you got to see this little lady who's out there, and you say, "Howdy." And she says, "Yes." I said, "My name is Charles Lindenwood. I'd like to see the Reverend." She say, "Who?" Well, after you got her straightened out on who you was, you get in to see the good man of the cloth, and he looks at you. And you see he don't recognize you. Drunks look different with their clothes on. So you see, actually, he didn't mean it when he asked you to come down there, and you ask him for $2, which you sometimes get and you sometimes don't. But actually, if you ever want money out of a preacher, I ought not to give this away. Go to church and sit right on the front row. And every time he says anything, look right up and say, "Amen. Amen." And first thing you know, he ain't talking to a damn soul but you. Amen. Amen. And it's just you and the preacher, boy. And when he gets through with his sermon, you make it to him the first one while the congregation's still waiting to shake hands and tell him what a good job did. Say, "Reverend, oh, that sermon. You did such a beautiful job this morning. You know I'm a sinner. And all of the sermons, but today, if you could see your way clear to let me have about $2. He makes that flank movement right now, because, see, this is what you call nuisance value. But you got to change churches. And unless you're a traveling drunk, I wouldn't sit by you. But a drunk will do everything in the world, and I want to tell you something else about drunks. Every time you see an old bleary-eyed drunk going into the sanctuary of a church, he's going in for more than $2. He's going in to feed his hungry heart. He's going in because he wants to know what it is that church is putting out that he needs. For that drunk, like you and like me, on many, many a lonely night, has turned his head to the mattress and cried and cried and cried, and walked and prayed and asked God for help. Oh God, is there no help for the widow's son? Many, many times he's prayed. And when he goes in there, did you ever go into a mission? When I was on the bomb out in L.A., they're full of missions out there. And you walk in there, I want you to know how I look now. When I walked in, I need a haircut and a shave, and I got on relievers for shoes and no socks. I had discarded my underwear for obvious reasons. And if I had anything to hawk, I wouldn't have been in the mission in the first place. And one of these lovely, lovely church workers who are on duty for that particular day take a double take. Oh, my God, no. What am I going to say to this one? And they come up and they say, brother. And you think, damn, they don't even know their own kinfolk. And then they say, have you been saved? And you think, great. Day in the morning. If I've been saved, wonder what do the rejects look like? And then they look at you and they cluck. Have you ever been clucked at? That's when they go. And then they go, oh. And in the deep south, they go, oh. And then, whatever is their procedure, I remember in one mission they had this series of benches. And they were all flat benches, and the last bomb in sat on the last seat, and way up in the front here was a lady up there giving you this. You know, that meant to come on in and get your bean. Well, I went in, I sat on this bench, and I worked my way up. All the way up. And this guy's preaching all the time. And I'm listening very quietly because I need some beans. And I finally got up and this lady gave me this. And said, would you like to say a prayer? I said, certainly. I was right adept at praying. I'd prayed more than she had. In fact, I'd been saved 2-3 times that same day. It was raining. And just as I knelt down, my wine fell out of my pocket. And they throwed my ass out on the street. Well, that preacher was in there preaching, and I'm on the walk preaching. And I just threw that in because there ought to be some sort of collusion, understanding. Well, up to now, I've been talking about my social drinking. And as I said, the family got together and decided I was a nut. So they told me, they said, now, Charlie, we're going to give you a choice. We're going to send you to a psychiatrist or we're going to bug you. I said, I believe I'll take the psychiatrist. And they sent me to the weirdest man you ever seen in your life. His hair run out on a stem. I is bugged out and ask you the weirdest questions you ever heard in your life. I mean, like, well, he said, do you drink alone? I said, indeed, I do. He said, you're an introvert. A few days later, I come back. I said, doctor, I have improved. He said, how's that? I said, I'm drinking with everybody. He said, you're an extrovert. He couldn't make up his mind what I was. And then he said to me one day, he says, Charlie says, did you ever have DTs? I said, I had them when they first come out. He said to me one day, he said, now, we gonna make a rundown of your day. I said, rundown? He said, yes. He said, now, what I want to know is what transpires from your awakening moment. I said, you want to know what do I do when I first get up in the morning? It ain't what you're thinking. He said, no, what I want to know is what manifests itself from your thinking from your very waking moment and on through the day. And knowing him to be as weird as he was, actually, he looked like he had enough troubles of his own without me burdening him with any of mine. And having this respect for the poor old thing, because I was about to give up on him by this time. He's so far gone. And I said, well, when I first wake up in the morning, the first thing I do is open my eyes. And then knowing him as I did, I explained why. I said, the reason I do this is to see where I wound up. And be damned if I didn't have to explain that to him. Seemed like he woke up in the same place every morning. Well, I said, after I determine where I am, I sit on the side of the bed, if it's a bed, and scratch and belch. And sometimes I do these last two things simultaneously. And then I light a cigarette and vomit. He said, vomit? I said, Satan, man, everybody does this. And he didn't know it. Oh, he was weird. Then one day today we're going to go back into your childhood. I said, go ahead, you've been everywhere else. He said, as a child, did you bite your fingernails? I said, indeed, I don't remember. I don't like them now. He said, did you pick your nose? I said, when it needed it. Then he said, did you wet the bed? I said, still do. I said, doctor, I got news for you. You're trying to find out the cause of my drinking. Wetting the bed ain't no cause of drinking. This is a result of drinking. And if you don't believe it, you drink yourself about a half case of brew and follow that with 2-3 skull busters, and then eat yourself 4-5 goofballs so you can rest. If you don't wake up in a puddle, boy, there's something wrong with your skin. Well, poor thing. We're sitting there talking one day, and I got this little black ball. I'm rolling it around in my hand, and he's talking, I'm talking, rolling this little black. Finally, he said, "How come you rolling that little black ball around in your hand?" I said, "Well, you ain't the easiest man in the world to talk to, and this kind of soothes my nerves." He said, "You mind if I try?" I said, "No." He tried it. He rolled it around in his hand. He said, "Does soothe your nerves, don't it?" I said, "Deed it does." He said, "Where did you get it?" I said, "Out of my nose." Well, wasn't long till I was in the nut house. Me and him both. But I got out. He ain't never made it. Poor thing, he was too far gone. But this is the kind of a guy that you accepted in the AA. I looked like I told you I looked when I walked into that mission, and I was down to 2 teeth, and they didn't match. And I love green onions. Did you ever try to eat a green onion with 2 teeth? I had climbed over a fence and I was picking these green onions and eating. The way you eat green onion with 2 teeth, I had one up here and one down here. I had to go kind of like that to make them hit, see? And I had picked 3-4 green onions. I was over the fence at 5th and F Street in Washington, D.C. And I picked some wild onions used to grow under those great big elm trees. They're about as big as your little finger. And the way you eat them is you split them. My cat, and then you give him a quarter turn. And you split him again. And then you know how impatient and impetuous alcoholics are. You grab and go like that, and you wind up with a little something look like a broom. And you suck that juice out, because that's nice. And there's a policeman watching all this, and I got one onion that's just split, and one ain't touched, and I'm gumming another one. Like that. And this policeman is giving me that crooked finger sign, and I walked over to him, and he said, "What in the hell are you doing?" I said, "I'm eating onions. I like green onions. Is it against the law in the nation's capital to eat green onions?" Well, he thought for a long while, and he said, "No, it's not. But seemed to me like if you're going to graze, you'd gone out in the country." And that's the way I looked when I came into AA. And that's the kind of a guy that you came over and shook hands with. You didn't shake your head. And you didn't ask me what my outlook on life was. You didn't ask me my religious denomination. You didn't ask me where I was going or where I was heading or what I was doing then. You didn't ask any silly questions like, "Where are you working?" One fella came over and brought me a cup of coffee, and he said, "Boy, you think you can hold this on your stomach? I don't want to have to mop this floor." I loved you for that. And I remember that meeting, they put me right on the front row amongst the incurables. And I sat there sweating and stinking and scratching. And there was a fella sitting right next to me that had a problem. Me. Because I got to giving it that, you know, and he knew that I had a few lice, small ones. And his problem was that he didn't want to hurt my feelings. Because he knew if anybody in God's world needed AA, it was me. But he didn't want to get lousy either. So he took his cigarette pack out of his pocket and said, "Have one," and I took two. And then he moved over to the next chair and put an ashtray between us and said, "We'll both use this." What an act of kindness. To appreciate me as a human being enough to not want to hurt my feelings because he didn't want AA to lose a prospective member. He wanted me to stay for that meeting. He thought enough of me to want to save me. And this is more than anybody in the whole world had thought of me in a long, long time, excepting my sainted mother. My mother had to tell me to leave home because she couldn't raise my younger brother in my presence. And I had become a bum with an alias. My right name is Charles Leonard Lindenwood. But this alias that I had was John Milton Van Dyne. Can you imagine? How weird can you get? I went to a flop house with 50 cents that you had paid for, and a man gave me two car tokens, one to pay my way down, one to pay my way back, and a 50 cents to pay for the flop. I had a sleepless night, and I remember laying on that cot, and I'd sweat, and get hot, and I'd get cold. I'd go to the bathroom and come back and lay down, and I didn't pray, but I hoped. I hoped that it was true that all you wonderful people had invited me back because you'd said, "Come back, come back, come back." And this beat in my ears like a drum and like a broken record. This thing kept going over and over. Come back, come back, come back, come back. And I thought, my God, if this were only true. And I remembered you men that with your warm, friendly hand clasp and your clear, sincere eyes. Some of you had bathed recently. I thought it was wonderful, but it was you women that made the real impression on me. You with your lipstick on your lips. And your teeth in. And you had your dresses cut so they hung straight all the way around. And you had your ballot battened down so there was no slippage. I thought it was great. I thought how wonderful it would be if I could introduce you to my mother and say, "These are the people with whom I'm associating now." I got a card printed, and on this card it says, "Charles L. Lindenwood," and gives my address in Arlington, Virginia, and it says, "Charles L. Lindenwood and Associates." I ain't in business. See, it was so many years that nobody would associate with me. Now they do. I put it right on the card. Well, I came back the next day as you suggested. I got up nearly daylight, and it took till almost noon to shave. I didn't take a bath. You said, "Easy does it." I walked up those steps, and before I walked in the room, I said, "My God, Charlie, you're crazy as hell. These people don't want you here. Here, a whole room full of nice, clean people have invited you back. This is weird." And I started to turn and go back down the steps, and then and there was when I had my spiritual awakening. For something came to me and said in such a manner that I, at my then present intellectual level, could absorb. This thing to me said, "Charlie, you better damn sight go up to those people. Because if anybody's going to lose, it's got to be them. You haven't got anything left to lose." I walked up those steps, and I stuck my head around, and there was a guy that had been at that meeting the night before, and he said, "Hey, here he is. This is old Charlie. This is the guy I was telling you about last night. Come on in, Charlie. The son of a bitch was betting on me." Boy, I'm glad he won his bet. I walked on in, and everybody in that room adopted me, and I needed anything you had. Anything. Shoestrings? Thank you. I didn't have no shoes to put them in. And a guy went home and got me some socks. Another guy said, "Charlie, your feet are cold and wet." He said, "Put them up against that radiator and let them get warm." I did. He regretted it. Another guy got me some underwear. Another guy got me socks. Another guy got me a shirt. Another guy got me a pants. Another guy gave me a laxative. I couldn't leave if I wanted to. Actually, I believe that's what hooked me in AA. And I'm sitting there sipping on this hot coffee and said, "Excuse me, I had to go to the bathroom." And I loved it. I loved it, and I wanted you with all my heart. And I sat there that day and hoped upon hope that it was really true, that you'd meant it when you said, "You belong here. This is your home. You have established a membership in AA by the simple expedient of saying that you want to stay sober. And you haven't had a drink since last night. And 24 hours from that time, you will have established one day of sobriety, continuous. And this makes you a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the only way you can break it is by taking a drink. You are the only one that can resign from AA. Nobody has the power to kick you out." God, if it were only true, if this, you wonderful people were really accepting me, if you wasn't just kidding me, and after a while you were going to say, "Get the hell out of here." You never hurt my feelings. You never said a thing since I've been in AA that was detrimental to my tender heart. And if there's anybody in God's world that knows what is meant by the tenderness of a human's heart that's lonely, it's you and you and you and you. For you have been there. I remember a psychiatrist told me, he said, "You're going nuts." I was nuts already. A medical doctor said, "If you continue doing what you're going to do, you're going to die." I stayed drunk 6 months to prove he was wrong. A preacher said to me, "You're going to hell." I'd been to hell barefooted, and so had you, and you, and you. And nobody could frighten me with death. I died every day. You didn't mind dying. It was this damn dying every day you didn't like. So nobody understood, and nobody wanted to understand. Everybody always said, "Well, now, if you'll just go over here, they'll tell you something to do." But you didn't say that. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you said, we will go together. You and me. And you and me have done together what I couldn't do alone. And by God's grace, and you, and Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had a drink for over 23 years. And I hope to God that with you and me and with God, that in 23 years from now, neither you nor me will have had a drink. God bless you. I love you.